Welcome to another episode of At the Table with Patrick Lencioni, where everything we talk about is related to changing the world of work so that more organizations can be more effective and less dysfunctional, and employees can be more fulfilled and less miserable. I'm your host, Pat Lencioni, joined as almost always by my co-host, Cody Thompson, back from vacation. How are you doing, Cody?
Feels good to be back. I know you can't say as always now. That's a real ender there. That's a funeral of sorts.
Yeah, we had our guest host, Chris Stefanik, last time. It's great to have you back, though.
I can't wait to listen to that episode. As you know, Pat, I don't really listen to our episodes, but I will listen to one I'm not on, so I can't wait to hear about it.
It's so much easier to listen to it when you don't have to listen to your own voice. I can vouch for that.
Yeah.
Tracy, how are you doing today?
I'm fine today. Thanks for asking.
You're going to keep us on the straight and narrow. Matt's on doing our engineering, as I say, on the keyboard, like he's our musician. And Karen's sitting here with me too. She reminds me of questions that I forget to ask and comes up with great ideas. Okay, Cody, what is today's topic?
The sport of business.
The sport of business. Yeah, we usually hear about people talking about the business of sports. People like to talk about the economics of sports and marketing. But today we're going to flip that around and talk about the sport of business, which is really, what is it that we learn from sports that applies to organizational life? And I would say sometimes people make too many applications. You know, everybody talks about sports and everything in sports is applied. And a lot of business people we talk about and organizational leaders use sports analogies. Sometimes we do it too much, but there are a lot of good things that come out of the world of sports that can help us in organizational life. And it's not just professional sports, but it's in our own participation in sports, whether we were young or whether we're still doing that. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. We thought this would be a fun summer subject. And there is a lot of relevant opportunity here. So
yeah. And on top of that, Pat, we used to have a sports culture podcast where we did this more often. And then Tracy made us shut it down. So now we get to resurrect it in a single episode here.
That's right. We loved that. And one day we will do that again, probably when Tracy's on vacation.
I was not the one that killed that.
That's true. You take a bad rap for it, but it wasn't.
I'll take the bullet.
Yeah. But it was fun. So we're going to talk a little bit about what we can learn from sports. And I think a great place to start, of course, is teamwork. You know, the five dysfunctions of a team, it's been out for 20 years. And we've had a lot of athletes and a lot of teams over the years say they use it. But what is it that we learn from teamwork in the world of sports that applies to organizations? And I think a big part of that is understanding that not every sports team is really a team. A golf team is not really a team. It's just a group of people that plays a sport and adds up their scores. But basketball, you know, soccer, certainly hockey, football in a different way, those are sports that require interdependence and have a common goal, and people are on the floor or the field or the rink at the same time. And so those are pretty good examples. And so what is it, Cody, that you think about, and Tracy, that from sports that applies so much to teamwork in an organization?
Well, one of the quotes that I hear a lot from your book, The Five Dysfunctions, that I say regularly with our clients is that teamwork is a choice and not a virtue. Because I do feel like there's this sort of general sentiment in all workplace that we need to be a team. There's this this innate feeling that, oh boy, we have to become a team. But there are, I think we've done at least touched on this on a different podcast, where there are a number of organizations or even, you know, quote unquote teams out there who really are more like a golf team than they are an actual team that is interdependent on their success. So I think just that first question of, hey, are we a team or are we not a team is sort of the most fundamental one when we talk about the analogy between sport and business. And then I think it goes right to, you could start at any level of that pyramid, whether it's at trust, but I think it goes right to the top of the pyramid, which is, hey, if we are a sports team, if we're a team and we're a team, even in a workplace setting, then our goal is to win. You know, it's not just okay that we play the game. We, as a business, we need to be successful and succeed. So that means as a team, we need to work together to achieve that outcome. That's where I immediately go with the sport analogy.
I totally agree. The key to teamwork in sports and in organizations is we have a common goal, and it starts there, which is why we were talking in the office today, and Matt made some good points about how football is a great example because every game matters. There's only 17 games in a season now. They just added one last year. And so losing one game can really affect the results of not only, obviously the game matters, but the season. Whereas in baseball, there is, I think there's now 4,555 games in a season. And so no one game is that important until you get down to the very end. And even in basketball, there's 82 games. And for the first three quarters of many games in the pros, and frankly, for the first three quarters of the regular season, it doesn't really feel like the outcome is that urgent.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right. If we don't really want to win and we don't feel a sense of urgency and immediacy, we don't really see people acting like teams.
Right. And you might even take it a step further. There's a mutual friend of ours, Lee Eilers, who's a Kappa Pro member, and I've gotten to know a little bit. He wrote a book on about his sort of what he learned around business and the principles that he learned. And it really is about business is about winning. And to take it a step further, it's about winning well. Like, it matters how you win. So it's not that like ruthless win at all costs and we need to... You know, like the bottom line is the only thing that matters. How you win is just as important. And I think that the analogy to sports is really similar. But at the end of the day, like, I think this is where, you know, I was on a very losing junior high school basketball team. And at the end of each loss, which was weekly for half a season, our coach would talk about how much character we're building. And there was still this innate, like, okay, there's some positives that are coming from this. No business or group of serious employees that work together can do that for a prolonged period without saying, like, if the results don't change, then this goes away. In business, it's sort of a meritocracy in that sense. You have to win or your business fails.
Yeah, and it's not always just money. Money is often an outcome. It's like, are we getting customers? Are we helping them succeed? And nonprofits should be just as focused on winning, but it's winning at whatever they set out to do. Now, in sports, we have a clear thing, and it's called a scoreboard or the standings at the end of the season. So that's what makes it easier. Now, so results is critical. You know what's interesting? There's this new league in lacrosse. So my kids play lacrosse, and they play through college. But there's a new professional lacrosse league, and they're trying to get it going. And it's interesting, but the truth is they don't pay a lot of money. It's not full-time. And you can kind of tell that winning the games is not that important. It's really about making the league work and the guys fly in for the games. And though lacrosse is very much of a team sport, when it comes to this professional league, it doesn't really feel like winning is that big of a deal to these guys. Hmm. And as a result, you see them doing things. It feels a little bit more like they're all trying to score and they're having fun, which is great. But I don't think until winning matters that it's really going to take off. Because when you're watching them and you realize they might rather score a tricky goal than actually do something that's going to help their team win, it's just not that interesting.
Well, and this is where I think this analogy is super helpful, because if you've used this before where you said, imagine a football team or a basketball team out on the court playing together, playing their hardest, sort of they're playing offense and defense, and they're interdependent on each other, passing and setting screens to be able to score. And if you are out there performing at a high level and you came off the court to the sideline and said, "Hey coach, you know, what's the score?" And the coach said, "Oh, don't worry about the score. We're playing really well together." You actually want to know. And I feel like that is similar on our teams. If you're a leader or a manager of a team, if you don't put the scoreboard up on some level, and like you said, it's not monetary always. In fact, more often than not, if you have your clarity, like, why do we exist, then the monetization of that is a downstream symptom of success. It means that, oh, we're helping our customers' lives, or we made a product that is making a difference, then the more you're winning, the downstream symptom is money. But that idea that, like, you're actually telling the stories of those customers that you're helping, or the stories of the people's lives that are changing as a result of what you're doing, that all matters. And to think that wouldn't matter in the meeting room the same way it would matter on the court is kind of a bad place to start if you're a leader or manager.
Yeah, we all need a scoreboard. We all need to know if it's working. You know, to dive into the world of sports and rules, what I would say, I think that both the Major League Baseball and the NBA should change their season so that they have at least two, if not three, mini seasons. And whoever wins that mini season gets invited to the playoffs. And if you win twice, then you get a bye, so that every game mattered more. Because the truth of the matter is, some little kid goes to a baseball game and says, this is my first chance to see the Giants or the Dodgers or the Yankees or whatever else. I really hope they win. And the players walk off the field at the end, go, it doesn't really matter. We got 160 more games to go. And so it's really interesting when you know that people care about the results. Mm-hmm. And so I think that teamwork and results go hand in hand. Now, I can't wait to talk about this, because Matt told us a great story that I hadn't even thought about, that because it's not just pro sports, but there's something about the immediacy and clarity of sports that makes us more willing to hold each other accountable too. So Matt, will you share that story with us?
Yeah. Well, so like I was saying earlier, I play basketball at the park almost every day, and there's guys there that I know well from seeing them out there, and there's guys that I don't know.
And it's really competitive, right?
Oh, super competitive. And regardless of how well I know someone, people are not afraid to hold each other accountable. And it's not everyone's like being a jerk yelling at each other, but people will like get upset if you don't do your job because of the immediacy of the result, which is if you don't win this 13-point game, you can't play the next game.
Yeah.
Then you stay, you're gone. So everyone is actually invested in winning the game because they want to keep playing. And so people are not afraid to hold each other accountable. And I'd say 90% of the time in a helpful way.
Yeah. I love that Matt, that you said that there are people that you've never met. You walk out onto the court to play together for the first time, and two up and down the courts, the guy will say, hey, Matt, you need to take that shot because you have a better chance. Don't pass it out of there. Do this. And yet we know people that work together every day that know each other on an intimate level, and this is their livelihood on the line, and we're reluctant to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting to think that if there were a scoreboard in your office, because like I can imagine a scenario where somebody didn't call out that there was a screen coming on your team. So you get blindsided by a screen and your guy goes in for a layup, and somebody would go like, hey, you got to call that out. What, you know, I need to know that that's coming. In the office, imagine like, oh, hey, somebody, imagine we had access to each other's emails, or there was a scoreboard on the, you know, inside our office building. And it would be like, hey, Pat, you actually didn't respond to that person within like a week window, and they went with somebody else. I need you to actually do a better job. I mean, that would be interesting to have sort of an analogous way of holding each other accountable in the moment. But if we don't have this like winning mentality, or if that there's this desire to kind of stay in my own lane, you don't actually do that in the office. Or say you're on a sales call and somebody makes a misstep and you're just the technical person. Do you actually go across the line and say, hey, I think you blundered that sales call, and it wasn't a technical aspect they said no to. It was actually because you mismanaged that opportunity. A lot of teams would walk out of there way more effective and way more successful if they were able to do that.
Right. And yet we're afraid of how people are going to receive that feedback in the office. But the guy on Matt's team is not afraid of him being too sensitive to saying, hey, take that shot next time, or play better defense on that. Mm-hmm. So what a great thing.
It's always helpful too.
Right. You like hearing that, right?
Oh yeah. Everyone on the court, almost everyone on the court is, when they get that feedback, they're like, when somebody says, you know, if somebody misses an easy shot and somebody says, you got to make that, they're like, yep, next time. And it's not personal. It's not, they're not being a jerk. It's just, everyone's trying to win.
When you can insert that kind of a culture into your team at work, your performance increases so much. And I think that's why there are companies out there that will hire people because they played on teams, sports teams in high school or junior high or college. And it's not because they want to talk about sports with them, but because they know they have given and received difficult feedback to make the team better. And I get that. It makes sense. Yeah, Trace?
So what makes us so sensitive in the workplace versus the basketball court? Because Matt, I asked you, I said, does that make you feel bad or emotional? And you said no. Yet my guess is, in the workplace, if someone actually had that direct conversation with you, it might be slightly more emotional. So what is that?
Even think about it this way, like Matt, you work with us, And you just described a scenario that is somewhat out of character for you. Like if you were on the basketball court and somebody missed a block or a block of like you block in basketball, if somebody like didn't box out or did something, you would call them out. You're a little more hesitant to do that on our team in our workspace than you are on the court. Is that true?
Definitely. And I think something about it, in sports, it feels like it's not addressing your character a lot. If somebody misses or if somebody doesn't do the right thing, you can tell them, hey, that's, you have to call that out, or that's your job. That's your matchup. You have to go there. It doesn't feel as much like you're talking about somebody's character. And obviously the environment makes a big difference in the sense that everybody's kind of talking to each other and not necessarily in the nicest way all the time, where as there's like a different decorum in an office. I think it's definitely easier like on the field. And I think it has to do with the immediacy thing, which is like, this has an immediate result. So like, we actually do need to address this right now.
Yeah. And it's clarity of your role and the immediate and the results matter. And it's too easy in the workplace to go, that might not matter. And we won't see the results of it for 2 months. So it leaves it up to subjectivity. But in the world of sports, it's really clear. If you don't cover your guy and he scores a touchdown or gets a layup, nobody's got any doubt that you missed that. But we need to bring that more into the workplace. So yep. Matt, from now on, if Tracy doesn't do something right, I want you to just go tackle her and right up against the wall. All right. That's great. I love talking about how teamwork works that way. Now, let's talk about organizationally in sports. You know, because what's interesting is I think on the field, the coach is really the CEO of a team, of an organization. But professional sports teams have almost always the most dysfunctional organizations in all of business. So what works on the field doesn't translate to what happens in the, you know, the owner's office or the general manager's office. Why is that? Why is it so dysfunctional there, but it's so functional on the field or on the court?
I should have asked you the question because I feel like you'd have a better answer, but there is definitely, you know, the analogy we use in the corporate world, Pat, is when we say if there's a lack of alignment at the executive level, if there's any cracks in terms of their cohesiveness, in terms of their behaviors, or ideologically speaking, like the clarity questions from the advantage, then that leaves the people in their department. So in the sports analogy, maybe it's the offensive unit or the defensive unit. You always say it leaves them to fight bloody, unwinnable battles with each other. And you're right. There's something sort of inversely related in the sports world where the offensive coach might not actually interact with the defensive coach in a team-oriented way, but expect their players to do it on the field. There's something that is that doesn't totally translate there. They feel more siloed at the top of that organization, and they require them to act as a team at the bottom.
Yes. You know, I didn't know what the answer was when I asked that question. Karen pointed something out to me, but Tracy, you had a thought.
Well, could it be that the owners / leaders of these organizations, this is like a hobby to them?
That's a huge part of it.
Yes.
It's a huge part of it. The truth is they do this. Most of these owners, this is not their career. This is what they're doing after their career. They've made a bunch of money. They bought a sports team. And the truth is, it's just darn fun to have such a toy to play with. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, which is one of the reasons why I love English soccer, because if your team sucks, they relegate you to a lower league. But in the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, NHL, even if your team is terrible, if the owner's okay with that and has a ton of money, there's really not a lot of accountability. So people are like, well, I can't push that owner too hard because he or she is really doing this for fun. So that's a big part of it. The other thing is, I think that in the world of sports, just like business, there is a tendency to focus on smart versus healthy. In other words, if you really went to an owner and said, tell me about why you're going to be successful next year, they'd say, well, we traded for this player and we're installing a new offense and we did this and we did this. And then you talk to them about the culture of their team, and they're usually kind of like, yeah, I don't know how to measure that. And just last night, I was watching TV. It was the first football game of the season. It's called the Hall of Fame game, which is basically they're 3 days into practice and they play their first game on TV. And there was a coach named Dick Vermeil. And he is like the most happy, positive. And he took two teams to a Super Bowl and one team almost to the Super Bowl. And the thing is, he created a culture of like love and affection and accountability, a really positive culture. And all of his teams after his third year of coaching did fabulous. It took him 3 years to build the culture, and then their performance went through the roof. But I think most owners, I'm almost sure of this because I see this and I've met some of them, they think of it as just X's and O's and dollars and cents and who they're going to draft and everything else. And the very best coaches and the very best organizations understand it's really about culture. And which is why the Patriots, again, are never terrible, even when their team doesn't have a lot of talent. And they've won so many Super Bowls. And even though it's not the kind of culture I would really want to play in, because it's pretty cut and dry, their culture works. And other teams think, we're going to sign this famous player at the end of his career, and he's going to take it. And it's like, yeah, if the culture isn't there, it's not going to matter. So I think it's the smart and healthy thing. It's just like Southwest Airlines. I think an airline is an airline, right? But Herb Kelleher went into that business, said, I'm going to create a different kind of company, and they win. And other ones that have the same planes, the same schedules, the same technology, everything else, don't. So yeah. I think that's particularly prominent among owners of pro sports teams.
Yeah, I think it's related. You're absolutely right. I think the smart and healthy thing is spot on, and it's plagued the professional sports industry as much as it does the professional business, you know, community. But I think that you touched on two things at the beginning of your book. In The Advantage, you talk about the three biases around why certain leaders or like executives wouldn't adopt organizational health. And one of them is the quantification bias that like, okay, so it's sort of like, prove to me that this is going to work. And how often do you see, you know, a coach like Dick Vermeil, who knows that culture is at the center of a successful team, but how often do you see an organization say, well, show me your playbook and your offensive scheme and show me all the smart things that you're going to do to make our team better, because it's too messy to sort of quantify the cultural aspects of that. So they go right to the things that they think they could measure. And the second bias, which is, I think, really prevalent in the sports world as well, is the adrenaline bias, which is, hey, we need something to change right away. Like last year, so I mean, think about a football team. They literally will change the head coach and two to three players. So like they're making in a percentage change that's 95% of the players are the same as they were the previous year. And if they had a losing season the year before, they think they can just immediately change it based on a new playbook, a new scheme. And so they don't take the long game. It's not like you say with organizational health, it's not years and years. It can be weeks and months to start to see some of those changes, but it doesn't happen overnight either.
Yeah. It's almost like when you're in traffic and you're constantly changing lanes and then you're falling farther behind. Oh, I got to get over there. I got to get over there. And it's like, and the teams that do that are perennially bad.
Yep.
The teams that go, we're going to stick to our lane. We're going to play this for the long haul. We're going to build a culture and it's going to work. Those are the ones that really work well. You know, it's so interesting. So for years, we've been teaching our clients to have better conflict. And I'm just thinking out loud right now, because that's at the base of the pyramid after trust. You know, you have to trust one another and then engage in conflict. I think conflict happens closer to the customer, closer to the results. And I think you're much more likely to find people in a sports organization to have conflict on the court than you are up in the boardroom. And similarly, I think you're going to find conflict to happen closer to the customer, where you can actually see the impact of your actions, than you are, you know, five levels removed and up in the organization. So conflict is another big part of this. And I think it gets back to immediacy and clarity of the impact of our behaviors.
Yeah, I like that a lot, Pat. The idea that, because I do think that you see people in an organization, whether they're if something isn't serving the customer well, or there's something frustrating the customer, they're actually more open to pushing back and saying, this isn't right, or we should change this, as opposed to higher up in the organization in the boardroom, where they're not seeing the effects of that, or the immediate, like sort of the, what Matt said, of the immediate outcome or the immediate loss of that. So that's really an interesting thing that we haven't explored before, but I like that.
You know, I was recently in an airport a few weeks ago, and I left my phone on the plane in the seat back, you know, the thing where you put the magazines and everything. And I was just walking out of the airport, and I said to my wife, oh, Laura, I left my phone on the plane. You know, that's panic these days. That's crazy. And so there I looked up, and I was on a Southwest flight, and I walked into the lost luggage place, and I said, okay, here's what happened. Here's the flight I was on. And they totally got on it. They gave me a pass. I ran back. I had it within like 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And why is that? And if I really believe if it were another airline, it would have probably been like, well, fill this out. We'll let you know. And I think it's because they really give freedom to the people closer to the customer to make decisions. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot less bureaucracy. And when I walked in there, I was so confident, I'm going to get my phone back, because Southwest will give these people the power and the authority to help me do that. And so, and I think that's kind of where this lies. And if somebody sitting there at the desk saw somebody else making it hard, they go, no, just call that other guy over there and go get it. Mm-hmm. Whereas I don't think that would happen at another place. So I do think it really is about the culture and what that has to do with sports. I guess just about the lower in the stadium it is, closer to the field, closer to the court, I think it makes all the difference.
Yeah.
What else about sports? I'm trying to think. I know there's more here.
The only other thing that came to my mind, Pat, that you and I have talked about before as it relates to sport and business, is there is this idea, because in professional sports, these professional athletes make big contracts. So they will sign to a maximum contract or something like that. And there's this sort of beholdenness to these large contracts, that they think of them as like sort of sunk costs. And we've talked about this, like when your starting quarterback that you just paid $30 million a year to is not actually the best person at the position, oftentimes the management of that team or the leadership of that team feels so obligated because of that contract that they continue to lose, even though the right decision is staring them right in the face. And we talk about how analogous that is to these decisions we make on teams and businesses all the time, of like,
Great point.
I promoted that person, or they've been here 10 years and we really got to get them there. And we should be playing with eyes wide open and sort of our reason about us. But there's these other factors at play, both in sport and in our teams and our companies, where it clouds our judgment.
I think it's a great point. Also, like we talk about in sports, so do you think a rookie is going to tell LeBron James on the floor that he didn't set a pick for him or he didn't play hard enough defense? Now, on a great team, any player should have the ability to do that. But when you're paid so much money and you are untouchable, that your coach and your general manager can't even give you feedback because you own them literally. I mean, like, you could literally buy the team out from under them, and they know that. It really inhibits teamwork. So when one person is too important on a team, and the people have to actually, imagine if Matt were playing basketball and LeBron James were to show up, do you think Matt would say, hey, LeBron, you need to make those easy shots? Now, maybe he would. But the point is, on a team, everybody should be able to do that. But if a person is paid so much money or seen as irreplaceable, I think it actually breaks down the ability to function like a team.
Yeah. It totally
That's a really does. Interesting point.
And changes the behaviors of everybody else on the team. And I think it's no different. I mean, so many people from the outside can observe that and see that that's true, or see that your starting quarterback is not the right person for that job, or what, you know, and still feel like they can't make a decision to either move that person out or reallocate, you know, the importance of each player on that team, or reemphasize the importance of every player on that team. But I think that does a real disservice both in sports and in corporations all the time, where there's one person who's seen as the most important, or there's an underperformer who you have so much, you know, sunk costs with, or, you know, like you're already pot committed to, that you don't feel like moving out for that same reason.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The final thing I want to say on this is that when you think about the leadership in sports and you're thinking about like, I want to run my own company or be a CEO or run a department, pay attention to the head coach, not the people in the organization. Because I think the head coach is the closest thing to a CEO and they are the hungry ones. I don't think a lot of professional teams are using our stuff as much as they could. We know some do, but a lot of coaches are. And I want to do a shout out to Eric Spoelstra, the head coach of the Miami Heat, who's I think the second longest tenured coach now in NBA. And he uses our stuff all the time. And he uses it on the court, off the court. And he's always been a believer that he has to be a leader to those players. And they won the championship with LeBron James, but then he had to coach teams without them. He's now made his team great again. He really makes the most of his players and he does it because he takes all of this seriously. So that's a shout out to our friend, Eric Spoelstra. And it's the end of our podcast. We want to thank everybody for listening. Sports is interesting and it has a lot to do with business and organizational life, whether you're on the playground or whether you're in the arena. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you next time on At the Table. God bless.